This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
The Earth was not made for us. She was made for the dinosaurs. The Earth was scaled to their dimensions. Human beings are ants crawling through their living rooms.
Welcome everybody back to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today we are looking at Carnosaur, 1993's dinosaur slasher, which is probably technically a movie, I think. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about this quote-unquote movie, our thoughts, and then go into the science, including the stances of dinosaurs, virus transmission, and then we'll explore the nature of a mockbuster. As always, we'll break the show up into those different segments and we'll have time codes below, so move ahead to whatever piques your interest today. But before we get started, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a parasite/disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup, and last of all, we are joined by Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist.
We watched a movie.
We watched a movie, yeah. But before we talk about one of the worst dinosaur movies I've ever seen, I want to briefly touch on one of the best pieces of dinosaur media I've ever seen, which is Prehistoric Planet, which came out this week. Now, I've been talking about this for a while. We're all big David Attenborough fans here, but this really exceeded my expectations. It is so lifelike, and they stay away from so many tropes that we commonly associate with these sort of documentaries, in particular with dinosaur documentaries. However, there has been a small but vocal minority who have taken umbrage at the fact that these dinosaurs are acting like animals.
As opposed to
movie villains, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been people getting annoyed at these two tyrannosaurs that face off against each other, and it turns out that one of them's a female and the other one's a male and they just want a mate instead. There is a variety of comments on the fact that there are very few fights between, like, I don't know, Triceratops and T-Rex, the things, you know, you kind of expect to see in these things, like big dinosaurs facing off in a primeval battle to the death. Of course, a lot of people have taken issue with the feathers. I should say that this is a small minority. The reviews for this thing have been overwhelmingly positive.
As they should be.
There's been a lot of comments of, these are not the caring mammals that we have today. These were primeval, basic species whose only concern was eating and fighting. Like, no, mate, no. And then the last thing I will say about Prehistoric Planet is that I was on Twitter and there were a lot of positive messages about a supposed queer icon. And I was very confused because, I mean, it's a documentary about dinosaurs. But then I got through episode two and yes, there is 100% a queer icon in episode two. So go and check it out. Yeah,
I'm intrigued.
Some of the trans people that I follow on Twitter have been particularly enamored of this individual. So, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. All right.
It's great fun. Yeah.
I have three bits of good news this week. One, the St. Louis Zoo welcomed two new critically endangered Amur. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Leopard cubs.
Amur.
Amore.
That's amore.
My second bit is that it was ruled that ExxonMobil must go to trial over alleged climate crimes.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Really?
Fuckheads.
Mm-hmm. And then last, the monarch butterfly numbers in Mexico have risen by 35%.
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
Which is awesome. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I'm going to talk briefly about monarch butterflies later on. But yeah, for those who don't know, they're an incredible species that perform a migration every year that we still do not understand the mechanics behind. It's incredible.
Yeah. And they're very closely tied with a lot of political issues in Mexico as well, with a cartel taking over land that they need to use to migrate. So it is a very dire situation, so it's really good that this year, at least, the population is growing.
Yeah. Especially given
that's a really good example of how everything's interconnected as well. The fact that a Mexican cartel taking over an area could affect the southern Canadian food web.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who she raises them and releases monarchs every year.
Yeah, if you can, plant some milkweed if you live in North America. It will really help. There's some little stopover sites for these because they need milkweed to survive. And because of the enormous monoculture problem we have in the U.S., there's not a lot of good spots for them anymore. That's part of the reason they're declining.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you live around the Great Lakes, because those are really important spots for them. A lot of them migrate directly over the Great Lakes, and it's the biggest kind of challenge they face along the way.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I cannot recommend this enough, the book Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver. It's an incredible account of monarch butterflies, and there's a lot of really good stuff about climate change and science communication in there as well. It's such a fucking good book. So lastly, just because we've been talking about Stranger Things the last 2 weeks, I just wanted to bring this up. This is not necessarily not at all ecology related. But, I mean, we all like most of the cast of Stranger Things, but Millie Bobby Brown has come out this week and said that she feels there's just too many people on there now. Like, the cast is too big and they should have been killing people off along the way like Game of Thrones did. How do we feel about this?
I agree!
It's interesting that the principal character with no threat to her role would say something like that.
Yeah. Billy Brown.
Exactly. Some would say after watching the first 3 episodes of the new season like I have, that maybe they should have killed off some characters, and maybe Eleven should have been one of them. You know, who knows?
Jonathan! What?
Nancy.
Nancy.
Jonathan actually looks like he's already dying. I don't know what's going on with that actor. I hope he's okay. Jesus Christ.
I actually disagree. While I detest some of the characters and I do think they should be killed, that's just my own personal preference. Yeah. I think for me, when you have an ensemble cast like that, it would be like killing off members of the Fellowship of the Ring. Like, you're kind of getting attached to these characters. And yes, you can have deaths that mean a lot, you know, Boromir. But if you start too killing soon. Them off en masse, you kind of lose that connection, and then all of a sudden the new cast is just replacing old cast, and it kind of starts to feel like a different show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked the death of, spoilers, Hopper at the end of season 3.
Yeah.
But I think he's coming back. Like, I mean, I'm pretty sure he's already been in press shots, and I like death to be permanent when it happens.
Yeah.
It was a good death.
I think they could do like one a season, maybe. I mean, I don't want to see wholesale slaughter of these actors. And the other thing is, I think Stephen King's books, that these are clearly, you know, inspired in some part by, I always felt like there was an element of cynicism to them, like the worlds were at time too cruel. Don't get me wrong, I do like the fact that people weren't necessarily safe, but I do like that there is a bit of hope in these movies, as opposed to Stephen King's works, which often felt, again, very cynical and kind of robbed of any joy in the world. So,
yeah. I think for me, especially when you're dealing with children, you know, like, it's not just killing off, like, Game of Thrones people willy-nilly. It's like, you're going to be killing off children. And to do that on, you know, in mass, like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tricky line.
Maybe they've just been waiting till they fucking get, you know, get old enough.
Oh, you graduated. You die.
Yeah.
Oh, won't somebody please think of the children?
With the setting in a town called Climax, Nevada, and a main character called Thrush, you would hope that this movie would steer clear of more vagina references, but instead makes them a central plot device. A mad scientist with the full support of the U.S. government decides to end the human race by way of breakfast and ovulation. What comes first, the dinosaur or the egg? Dr. Tiptree says, ¿por qué no los dos? By infecting chicken eggs with a virus that causes all women to fatally give birth to dinosaurs and genetically modifying dinosaurs born via chickens. The crazy doc, not to be confused with the character in the movie named Doc, who's not a doctor, wants to abort humans from the face of the earth. There's simply no womb for them. A quarry equipment night watchman, Doc... Thank you. A quarry equipment night watchman, Doc, grabs life by the tubes and penetrates the other Doc's laboratory in an effort to figure out how to stop the virus. He listens to the villain's speech, gets the cure, but is introduced to her full-grown pet. Unfortunately for the dinosaur, Doc has his heavy machinery license and uses a loader to have a rather gut-wrenching moment with the dinosaur. None of it really matters, though, as the U.S. government demonstrates its true pro-life values and murders everyone in the area.
This was a hell of a ride.
Oh my god.
I didn't even know how to summarize this movie, to be honest, because there was just so much going on. Like, my summary, ladies and gents listening, is just literally the tiniest fraction of almost what happens, I feel like.
So, who has something they liked about this?
I mean, I was pleasantly surprised by the somewhat prescient and aware nature of the ecological and conservational messaging of this movie. It definitely didn't seem to be on purpose. They just needed to have a jokey, quote, false antagonist in the hippie commune that live in the middle of the desert that are, I'm assuming, all vegan, all animal rights activists, potentially PETA members, which is a problem. Look it up. PETA's a terrible organization. It's funny for a movie that's 20 years old to already be touching on the impact of human industrialization.
30 years old
now. I was
now.
About to say it's...
Oh, almost... yeah, 30. I think it's one of those things where I tend to associate that kind of environmental messaging and modern media. There was a very on-the-nose episode of the new season of Love, Death, and Robots that touches on just that. And seeing this in a 30-year-old movie was fun for me.
I never knew at any point in this film what was going to happen next. Like,
yeah. I will co-sign that.
You never know what's coming in the next Absolutely. Scene. Nothing, take nothing for granted when watching this.
It's almost like there's no logic.
Yeah, or absolutely. Structure. It was really funny because I just watched two episodes of Prehistoric Planet before this. So coming from that level of amazing dinosaur CGI to the most janky, like, hand puppet robots ever, incredible. It was almost quaint. And that was a really fun experience. And the line, "Hello, my green brother," by one of the hippies before he gets ruthlessly murdered. I don't know why, but that set me off. I really found it quite funny.
I think, doesn't he say peace? He says peace, green brother.
Yeah.
Peace, green brother.
Yeah, peace, green brother. Because that line made me laugh a lot, too.
It did.
I think for me, kind of bouncing off Sam, I thought the Carnosaur was equal parts fucking adorable and hilarious.
All of them.
Yes. Like, from the hand puppet just, like, running across the screen to, like, the little embryo dancing like this. And then the big one that just constantly has his mouth open, just like, running by. I loved it. I just thought he was great.
Yeah.
It really
looks exactly like when you used to, you know, play with dinosaurs as a kid, the way they'd kind of run when you're doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And also the cast is actually good. I don't know about the script helping them out any, but, you know, you have Diane Ladd and you have,
Clint Howard. That's the one.
Yeah, yeah, that's him.
Yeah. So you have Diane Ladd, you have Clint Howard, you have, Raphael, I don't know how to say his last name, Sabarge, as the main character. Yeah, like, they actually, like, are pretty prominent actors, and it's just kind of weird to see them in this early role, I guess. Well, some of them it's not even an early role.
I'm gonna take my likes from potentially the unintentional but absolutely fantastic lines. The movie unfolds with one of the characters calling to the guard station and saying, "Under no circumstances are any trucks with chickens supposed to get out." And the truck rolls up to the guard station, and the truck guy's like, "Come on, man, I gotta get these chickens out of here." And the guard, without even doing an inspection, just looks back at the truck and he goes, "Yeah, it looks fine. Get going."
I'll say you already left.
When Doc gets out of his crane and there's the environmental protesters running away from it, his exact line is, "Hey, I got a gun and I can't shoot for shit." Which I was like, is that a threat? Is...
Yeah.
If I try to miss you, I might hit you. Watch out.
When he has arrested the woman and calls the sheriff, he says, "Hey, I got a girl here." And she goes, "Not a girl, a woman." When they're discussing the animal DNA that's present in the cut, the woman looks at the camera this seriously and goes, "That or the animal that intact him was a chicken," which objectively in any film is fantastic. My last two absolutely favorite ones were in the diner that they're in. The waitress saying, "You've been watching too many Italian zombie flicks." Like, she held the eye so long. And then the absolute pinnacle of any one-liner was after he has finished killing the Tyrannosaurus Rex using the crane. And the poor thing is lying there dying as it takes its final breaths. And what I only assume was supposed to be a heart-wrenching moment, he says to himself, because the female lead has passed out at this point, "God, I hate wildlife." Which is
yeah. so good.
Fuck yeah. you.
My favorite really corny bit was when the potential buyers were sampling the blueberries.
Yeah.
And the guy's just like...
It's fucking weirdo.
Leaned over, lying on the table, fucking salivating over them.
He's like centimeters from their face, just like... On, literally on top of the table, their plate is in front of him.
What did we not... What? Okay. What did we particularly not like about this movie? You've got to pick out some things in particular, yeah.
Well, there goes mine, because I just wrote the entire movie.
The entirety of just how bad the science is for a movie that is supposed to be science fiction. I get that this shit can never happen, but at least Jurassic Park took steps to be... Or Michael Crichton, I should say... Say, hey, look, there's these things that we can do. Maybe you just move it a step further and it becomes this fake thing that actually maybe could be real because it's just a little bit beyond what we're already doing. These fucking idiots say that the dinosaurs were walking this valley 60 million years ago. No, they weren't. They all died off 5 million years before that. The unexplained viral counter at the bottom of the screen that just pops up in some scenes but not in others and doesn't really explain. It has the counter listed as infected cells per 1 million. Followed by a percentage. For those of you that don't know, a percentage tells you how much of a total number or a total fraction a number makes up. 50% is one half of something. You cannot have a percentage of 1 million and have it be listed like that. That's just not how percentages work. It's not how numbers work. You're just not doing the right thing. It is so stupid.
This movie, I love a good movie that's so bad it's good.
Yeah, thanks.
But this wasn't that. This was... nonsensical. Nobody was fiendishly villainous enough to make this, you know, a little bit ridiculous. Diane Ladd was far too restrained for a movie of this nature.
So restrained.
Yeah. I wanted this to be one of those awful, awful movies that you just watch with a beer and laugh at, but it wasn't that at all. It's just so nothing and nonsensical.
Yeah. I really didn't like that the puppy in the pet shop got...
Oh my god, right?
Or all the pets in the pet shop.
Or all the pets in the pet shop, yeah.
Continuing on that point, misdirected aggression at characters that really did not deserve it. The woman who has handcuffed herself to the forklift, when the dinosaur comes up and just like tears her leg off, and we get a solid like minute of it chewing off the leg before she looks down at the torn stump, and the dinosaur's eating it, prepared to eat her the rest of the way. And at that point, my partner was like, "What the fuck are you making me watch?" And I was like, "I don't know."
I really did enjoy that the dinosaur was eating her leg like a chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
how humans would eat a chicken leg. Yes.
A little precursor to our discussion on the needless violence against women in these movies that we'll touch on in Jurassic World next week.
The man who has just lost his daughter, who finds himself trapped in the laser room with the T-Rex, which was also a, like, I'm like, oh, you guys made lasers on top of making T-Rexes.
This is a laser?
Why not?
Who gets his hand chopped off when he tries to run away right before he gets eaten. And then the last was the poor receptionist. The one who seems, like, quite lovely, who's been helping the lead female doctor. And she's just like, oh, I thought, I was hoping that you'd be spared. You created a virus that you said will affect every single woman on the planet. And you're like, oh, but I was hoping you would be spared. No. That's why you're doing percentages per million. Your math is not good.
I don't know. I think that violence, it did annoy me in this movie, but in the Jurassic Park franchise in general, violence against people who don't necessarily deserve it has always been a part of those movies.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It certainly reaches a peak in Jurassic World, though, for one certain character, but I don't think it's necessarily off-brand there.
No, I mean, it's a far cry from the 80s slashers movies where those characters are punished for having sex, but yeah, this is a very different
thing. instantly. Like, and that crops up in this film as well. There's a couple that is getting a bit frisky in a car, and you're just like, oh, okay, they're dead.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Fuck these people having consensual sex. Like,
well, this poor dude's taking a leak in the desert, having his dick bitten off by the Carnosaur. Like, it went straight for his dick. Why?
Dude, yeah. The Carnosaur does have a thing for dicks, because that's how he kills the sheriff later, too. He, like, stabs him right up the taint.
Oh, oh shit. I shot him in the dick. You shot me in the dick!
Ah! Trivia this week. This is based very, very loosely on a book called Carnosaur that came out, I think, about 4 years before this, 4 or 5 years beforehand.
Emphasis on very loosely.
Very, very loosely. This is a huge departure from the book. So the original book, Carnosaur, was about a man who had genetically created dinosaurs and turned them not into a theme park, but a circus. And they escape, shit goes bad, which sounds very similar to Jurassic Park, but it's actually written 5 years before Crichton wrote Jurassic Park.
Wow.
They purchased the rights to Carnosaur to make a movie in 1991 from Harry Adam Knight, who was a pseudonym of an Australian author whose name I can't quite remember right now. And they had the rights for 2 years. Then they heard that Jurassic Park was coming out, and they said, okay, we'd better rush this movie.
And it shows.
Rush they did.
Like, you would think that since Jurassic Park was coming out, you would just adapt the novel, which is pretty close to Jurassic Park. But they went in the complete opposite direction. This movie is so far from the book and so far from what Jurassic Park is, which is a very, very strange choice.
I mean, yes. It just shows that these kind of stupid studio decisions have been going on this whole time. You have a source material that I don't know if it was enjoyed by readers, but it is probably better than this nonsense. So instead of taking this perfectly good source material, let's just change everything and make it cooler, more interesting. And look at this nonsense you end up with. In the same year, Jurassic Park comes out. Look at these two movies side by side. They are made in the same at the same time, and one of them is Jurassic Park, and the other one is a high school student film from the 70s. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. At the same time, I don't want to give too much credit to the book. I haven't read Carnosaur, but I have read other stuff by Harry Adam Knight, and it's not good. Like, it is pulpy trash in the most pure sense of the word. And a lot of the unnecessarily violence against women and sexualization of women is 100% there in his books, too. So, right. I cannot recommend either. I can't recommend the book at all. Like, it's... I can't recommend anything by him, to be honest. But, yeah. So, there is a very, I wouldn't call it cheeky. I'd call it very blatant. I don't even know what you'd call it. But there's a line in this movie which is like, so, re-engineering dinosaurs sounds like it'll make a cool theme park halfway through this
right?
movie. Like, yeah. We get it. We get it. We get it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fucking, yeah. But I don't know if that was a jab at Jurassic Park or an homage to the earlier book. I don't want to credit this movie's crew with knowing what an homage is, so I'm going to say it's a jab at Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
From my understanding, it is, especially with the bit of trivia that I have, which is that Diane Ladd is Laura Dern's mother in
yes.
real life.
Oh.
Yep. And so that was definitely a bit of controversial casting at the time as well, because they sort of were aware, the two movies were aware of each other. So I don't know if that was intentional, but kind of seems like it.
I mean, at least Diane Ladd only had to work 5 days on that film, so she was in and out and was able to enjoy her daughter's achievement with Dr. Ellie Sattler's portrayal.
I wonder if she went and visited her daughter on set at Jurassic Park. Just like, my God, this is different from where I came from.
Fuck this, I'm going to Hawaii.
You're doing well.
Yeah.
Where do you guys keep your claymation miniatures and puppets that look like they came out of yeah. Sesame Street? Like, where is the box that those come in?
Look, this is cool and all, but do any characters in your film have to give themselves a cesarean with their bare hands?
Oh, my God.
Do you give birth to a dinosaur,
Yeah.
I do think it was also interesting that Clint Howard, who we've talked about earlier, is the uncle of Bryce Dallas Howard, who is in the new Jurassics. It's a family business, apparently.
You killed Ron Howard!
Okay, I'll stop.
Before we get stuck into the science, if you've got any thoughts, questions, or reviews, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hassick Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. We're also on Discord. You can find our server in the episode description or on the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a talon up the taint's worth of short stories.
Jesus.
And if you want to hear more, and if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can check out Ecology for the Masses by articles by us and a massive team of international writers. On top of that, if you have the time, it would be great if you could log into your podcast app and give us an in-app rating, preferably the opposite of what all of us gave this movie, which is 5 stars. I'm saying that's the opposite of what we gave this movie. We would give this movie 0 stars, presumably. Would anybody give it 1 out of 5?
No.
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 Maybe.
No.
What I thought was really entertaining in this is that this came out at the same time as Jurassic Park, but you can see from the dinosaur that there is a very markedly different stance of the main dinosaur, which I think is supposed to be a T-Rex, but I'm really, really not sure.
It is.
It's a T-Rex.
It is a T-Rex. Okay. But this is very in line with initial depictions of T-Rex in literature, the kind of standing up, tail dragging along the ground behind it. From 1905, which was the first representation of T-Rex in paleo art, right up until the mid-1970s, this is the way that T-Rexes, and even just theropod dinosaurs in general, were depicted. So you have that in King Kong, you have that with the Allosaurus in the Valley of Gwangi. And that's how museums that had reconstructions of theropod skeletons depicted these dinosaurs as well. Opinions didn't start to change on how these theropods looked and walked until about the late 1960s, when a series of papers came out saying, hey, this is probably not how these dinosaurs would have walked around. This is not the stance they would have had. And look, a lot of this sort of stuff we got initially from birds and the way they move. Like, you see ostriches, you see emus, they have their heads upright. They don't walk with their heads bent out in front of them. I think we've talked about this study before, where there are a group of university students who essentially put a plunger onto the butt of a chicken. And we saw that with the false tail out the back, the stance changed immediately. So obviously the chicken plunger experiment came later on, but this sort of got brought into paleontology, like I said, in the late 1960s. And over the next 2 decades, it made its way into paleo art as well. So when Jurassic Park came around, and a few movies before that, we had a T-Rex that was more horizontally aligned with the ground. And we see that in almost all forms of media nowadays. But this upright posture is an image that still lingers with a lot of people. There was a study at the University of Ithaca in 2013, and they had students, both college students and pre-college students, they just said, hey, draw a T-Rex. And the majority of them had the more upright posture, which is interesting because they're all raised on Jurassic Park as well. So that upright image has really still lingered with a lot of people.
They're raised on Jurassic Park, and I finished university in 2013, so I would have been around the same age as these students, and as a kid, the T-Rex toys that I had were the upright ones. I saw the T-Rex in the more standard horizontal posture in the movie, but a lot of everything else that I was exposed to when I was a kid was the upright posture.
And other forms of media. The Bat Cave has a Tyrannosaurus Rex historically in the comics and all the cartoon shows that Batman keeps his animatronic T-Rex, and it is in the upright posture, and it's always the one that I draw whenever I draw a T-Rex.
Well, there we go. Yeah. So this has really seeped into our, you know, public consciousness over the last 100 years. And despite the fact that Jurassic Park is arguably the best known dinosaur movie ever, it still hasn't quite sunk in that that's not how these dinosaurs moved, despite the fact that we've known about it for about 50 years. But much to my amusement, this is far from the only dinosaur that we've initially gotten wrong. And it's far from the biggest mistake we've made, which is fine. Like, we didn't know anything about dinosaurs for the longest time. I'll talk about the first discovery of a dinosaur bone later on, which is the best misidentification of them all. But one that people might know is that of Iguanodon. So Iguanodon are these large theropod herbivores that have enormous thumb spikes, which were used as weapons against attacking carnivores. But they originally thought it was a nose horn. And so a lot of the early depictions of iguanodons were based on the fact that we thought they looked like iguanas. So they were four-legged and they had this enormous spike, much like a rhino on the end of its nose. There is an amazing set of statues in Crystal Palace in the UK called the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs, which includes two of these iguanodons, plus a megalosaurus, which were all thought to walk on four legs as well, because we just kind of didn't understand how beings this big could have possibly supported themselves on two legs. And these things, they look amazing. They're such a fun slice of early paleontology. So if you're ever in London, I can't recommend enough visiting the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs.
We've talked a little bit about the Bone Wars before, which was the series, a famous series of academic and personal rivalries and battles between Othniel Charles Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope. Again, look these gentlemen up. They look like exactly what their names sound like. So in 1868, the Edward Drinker Cope reconstructed an Elasmosaurus skeleton, Elasmosaurus being one of the creatures that many people think the Loch Ness Monster is. Big saurian dinosaur that has the, or reptile, I believe, actually, that has flippers for limbs, long neck, long tail. And when he just reconstructed this, no one had done it before, so he put the head on the end of its tail instead of on the neck, which no one had really seen this before, so it happened. But according to the legend, it was very quickly pointed out in a not very friendly way by Marsh that this guy was a fucking idiot and he did this wrong, and this became the first shot in the Bone Wars.
Yeah.
The first bone he picked with him?
Nice. I mentioned Megalosaurus before. Megalosaurus was actually the first dinosaur we have a recorded fossil of back from 1763. But when this fossil was found, the man who found it thought it was an ossified pair of giant testicles. And I don't mean like enormous testicles. I mean giants. Like he thought giants were a thing and that they were a pair of giant balls. So the first scientific name that was ever given
yes.
to a dinosaur fossil was Scrotum Humanum.
Yes.
Okay.
Which, if you read the Bible, you know all about the giants.
Yeah. The Bible, Harry Potter. Probably some other forms of media that aren't springing.
Because, right as now. We all know, soft tissue fossilizes so easily. It doesn't. Giants existed. They didn't. And testicles were the thing you'd find, not the rest of the skeleton. Because yep. they would have just been carried off somewhere, because you always separate the testicles from the rest of the body. What the fuck are these people
I'm
thinking?
A little confused here that Adam hasn't simply accepted that obviously a wizard petrified and basically turned the giant into stone and then kicked him to pieces. Yeah. That's the obvious answer here, Adam.
Clearly. Like,
yeah. For someone on a science podcast, you're not using rational thinking
yeah,
very well.
Like,
you're right. I should have thought about the documentary The Hobbit, A Fantastic Journey, and how those trolls get turned
right.
to stone by
yeah,
magic.
They just got hit by sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You idiot! I'm sure you're right, but why?
So, there is a fantastic line in this that I'm hoping that you guys had at least a similar reaction to than I did, where when faced with the virus outbreak that's been brought on, our Doc character, explaining to the lead scientist, says, well, where is the original sample of the pure virus? And she goes, well, it doesn't really fucking matter because the virus is out there right now. And he goes, no, as everyone knows that if you can find a sample of the pure virus, you can make an antivirus. The fuck?
It's like gaslighting the audience. Like, you know this. You'd be stupid not to.
Right, like, no.
Also, classic man explaining to this doctor who happens to be a woman who made the fucking virus how viruses right. work and how she can fix it. You moron. She is clearly so much smarter than you.
Now, there is such thing as an antivirus. It runs on your computer. It comes in the form of Norton makes one. There's also a McAfee in biology. No. Mm-hmm.
They're all problematic and will fuck up your computer. Don't do it.
There is absolutely...
Are you listening, Dad? Don't do it.
There's no such thing as an antivirus. And I feel like the lead female scientist, when he's like, oh, well, you'll have to give me that virus serum, is just like, okay, fine. Like, you can have the bottle of virus serum or dinosaur piss or whatever the hell that is, because she's like, I am about to have to perform a C-section on myself. You can take whatever the fuck you want. Get out of here. Now,
also, pure virus isn't a fucking thing.
Right.
I mean, maybe we can give the movie some, quote, credit by assuming that our very obviously smart character, Doc, is implying that this virus would have evolved by then, which it probably would have. But maybe this is the ancestral original strain, which is a thing.
As we've talked about on this podcast before, viruses are fascinating as far as, I mean, I hesitate to call them organisms because we still have that discussion as to exactly, are they alive or dead? But I mean, this is a debate that continues to rage on. There are such thing as antivirals. And I mean, we think of them most commonly in situations like HIV. The idea being that we can give a human patient something that, unlike most antibiotics, do not destroy the target pathogen, but instead inhibit development. And what we mean by this is viruses at their very basic level are just a piece of information, DNA, that gets stuck to the outside shell of the cell, gets pulled inside, hijacks the cell's machinery to produce more of itself, and then eventually in typical viral standards, causing the cell to rupture or break enough that it can then release its contents and replicate that same process over and over and over again. Adam, would you say that's a sufficient definition?
Yeah, I would also say that it's not always DNA. Yes. It could be RNA, but it's just a piece of genetic material that replicates itself at the expense of other cells.
So we've come up with a variety of different products that are harmless to the host and that we can use in these situations. And the way that they are supposed to work is basically by binding at different stages of where the virus comes in contact with the cell. So whether or not that's binding to the virus before it gets into the cell, binding to the virus basically at the entry point or blocking the gate that it usually uses, blocking its ability to uncoat. Once the most viruses are coated, and when they're pulled into the cell, if we can block that ability for them to be uncoated and then interpreted by the cell itself, or blocking synthesis or eventually viral formation, blocking any of the steps, you're basically trying to toss a wrench into the machinery anywhere along. It doesn't stop the virus. You're slowing its process and you're trying to inhibit it. And by using these products, we have drastically increased survival time for many viruses like HIV. People are able to survive for much longer periods of time just based on the fact that we're inhibiting, not stopping, development. I would like to think that maybe he was intending on bringing this bottle back and trying to come up with a modified antiviral. But I mean, the thing about most antivirals as well is that generally speaking, they're pretty nonspecific. We can use them for a variety of different viruses in different families because they're working on the same set of mechanisms. And that's one of their most useful characteristics. There are products called viricides, which are designed to destroy viruses. We don't use them inside the body. We spray them onto a variety of surfaces to try and destroy viruses. If you try to give them to people, they are heavily toxic and you will kill the virus. By killing the host, you kill the virus.
It's like injecting bleach for COVID. You'll kill it and you'll also hurt yourself quite a bit.
Using hydrochloric acid to clear over those pimples. Can't have pimples if there's no skin.
Checkmate, atheists.
I love the idea of him making up this random word and being like, I'm going to make an antivirus. And then taking this bottle back of what I'm only hoping is dinosaur piss, because that's all I can think of when she hands him the bottle. And at the
the bottle of water with green food coloring?
At the very end, him getting like shot up, and we as the movie viewers are supposed to be like, no, Doc was going to save us all. And I'm like,
but
with his bottle of dinosaur piss? Like
Bugs Bunny with some like, you know, Michael Jordan special water taped onto the side.
The more interesting point that I think I wanted to talk about with you guys and get your feedback in on this ridiculousness. So they discuss that this virus that she has made will spread out and affect all women on the planet, killing all of them secondary to destroying their ability to reproduce.
Good fucking luck.
Viruses tend to fall into a number of different categories that relate to the ease at which they can spread from one individual to another, that fall into their mortality rate, how often they are to kill you or succeed in whatever their viral load is, and how easily they can spread kind of like through a population generally. You can't have all of these features, okay? There is no Superman virus that is really, really effective, spreads to 100%, and then accomplishes 100% of the time.
No Darwinian demon.
Like it,
yeah, because Adam, I think when we were talking about this recently, you basically said that it can't happen because it's not good for the virus. Like you can't just be killing your host constantly.
Yeah, it's not, I'm not the leading expert in the field by any means, but I've literally written a paper talking about virus evolution, and there's a trade-off that happens with viruses of either being really, really good at damaging the host, or being really, really good at getting from one host to another. The virus will increase its fitness by doing one or the other. It can't do both at the same time, so usually it's going to trade off by being somewhere in the middle for both of them. And this virus is incredibly transmissible. It goes from one person to another very quickly, it affects them very quickly, and it does damage pretty quickly. So it's both super virulent and super transmissible, which, if you do that, you kill off all the hosts, the virus then dies, and it's a really shit strategy for the virus.
And, right. There's too much resistance, too much variability between humans to create something that affects all of us. So the Black Death, in terms of its ability to wipe out, is estimated to have killed between 30 to 60% of all Europeans, as just
potentially 100 million people.
Right, which is an insane amount of numbers. This is where the math of not saying percentages and per million cells is useful. Because if you wipe out 60%, there's still fucking 40% left. I don't know if this was this podcast. We were discussing lice and the fact that many doctors have actually started encouraging parents not to just simply hit their kids right off the bat with lice-killing medication, because we're starting to see resistance develop so readily.
Oh, this has been happening for the best part of 2 decades. Right. We talked about rapid evolution recently. If you've got the best thing you can do for your kid, if they've got head lice, shave off all their hair.
Right. And so, anyways, the idea that this is just affecting everything, it just wouldn't happen. And yes, there are incredibly effective viruses. So, example, rabies has a 100% mortality rate. Humans that are affected, they fucking die. But generally speaking, it's not exactly a super easily transmissible virus. If every single one of these had to be a pregnant mother biting another pregnant mother, I'm not expecting that this is going to spread all that readily.
No, not very much. It's not going to be a very good strategy to get from one host to another.
Yeah. And isn't this making the women pregnant?
Right?
And I thought this was making the women pregnant. Yeah.
It's specifically infecting the women. The men seem to be fine.
Yeah,
but there's also the implication that, it is making them pregnant, and because there is that bit of romance at the end of the movie, but I don't think Doc and Thrush, I don't think Doc and a yeast infection have slept together at this part of the movie. But I'm hoping that the implication is not that the sheriff's, children, his female children, are going to be having dinosaur babies at 10, 8 years old.
They do say that the kids have the fever as well, so...
Yeah.
They have the fever, So it seems like that's the implication.
In summary, no one in this movie seems to have an understanding of how viruses work, how viruses spread, or how to stop them.
Now, speaking of that, I think the most egregiously dumb idea in this whole movie, the seeds are planted for it very early in the movie when Thrush says that this area used to be a dinosaur highway. And then later on...
60 million years ago, remember. Important detail.
And then the T-Rex jumps onto the highway and starts attacking things, and Doc proclaims that it still remembers that this was a dinosaur highway. Now, first of all, no, it's just stressed. It's taking the path of least resistance. There's some cars in there, but, it's just the easiest way for it to travel in any direction. I think that's the case. But, I mean, genetic memory is an interesting concept. It's largely garbage, but the science around memory and the genes that concern memory, I think, is really fascinating. We talked about monarch butterflies earlier in the episode. Now, for a lot of migrating species, when they start to migrate, they are following other members of the species. That might be family members, or it might just be cohort members, or they might just be, following other members that they're seeing. So they're learning behavior in a lot of those cases. But monarch butterflies, we have no fucking idea how they make this migration and how they know to make this migration from Mexico to southern Canada, over the whole of the USA, over the Great Lakes. There are a lot of theories.
Important detail about that is that it's not a single monarch making it from Mexico to Canada. They do it in steps. So you'll have a monarch fly from central Mexico, maybe to northern Mexico. It will stop. They'll mate. They lay eggs. Those eggs turn into caterpillars. Caterpillars go to pupae. Those pupae go into more butterflies, and those will then fly another couple hundred kilometers, a couple hundred miles. same thing, rinse, wash, repeat, all the way up to Canada.
And the parents are just dying. They're not flying onwards with them. They're dying. So we have no idea how this happens. There are a lot of theories. There's a lot of science that goes into this. There was a man called Lincoln Brower, who died at age 86 4 years ago, who put his life's work was trying to figure this out. And he was an enormous figure in the conservation of monarch butterflies. And he advanced this science enough, but they still don't really have a very precise idea of how this happens. He was actually, the book we talked about before, he was one of the lead consultants for Barbara Kingsolver on the book. But yeah, so this concept of genetic memory, there's still a lot of things we don't quite understand about how species know how to do this sort of stuff. I don't think that relates to the Carnosaur at all. But what is really interesting, a study that was made on snails, which just blew my mind that people would even think to try and do this, right? So essentially what the researchers did is they trained one snail. So they essentially sensitized it to a behavior, taught it to avoid something. They associated something with pain.
Was it a small cricket wearing a top hat and a whip in kind of a circus style with like dun, 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 playing in the background as he like cracked it in the background? Was that the way that they trained them?
Very possibly.
Okay.
The idea is the same, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, they shocked the tails of the snails. They shocked the snails' tails, and they essentially sensitized it to this behavior. And then they extracted RNA from the snail's brain and injected it into another snail that had never been exposed to these tail shocks before. And once this procedure was completed, the completely naive snail showed the ability to retain memory from the other snail, which fucking blew my mind. So I don't know if this could happen with other species, but there is precedent for transferring some sort of recognition from one individual to another. Now, where they're getting that individual from that recognizes this area as a dinosaur highway, I don't know. I didn't think that far. The movie certainly didn't either.
I enjoyed Sam's story of the tale of snail tails relating to dinosaur trails.
There's another false representation of genetic memory that pops up a lot, which is phenotypic plasticity as a response to environmental conditions. It's just like, oh, how did the species know how to grow this way? It's just an expression of the genes in that kind of, in that area. It's not a representation of genetic memory. It's environmental conditions influencing the expression of those genes, which, I mean, you can call it genetic memory if you want. But that's not how we typically think of genetic memory. I think the closest thing we'll ever get to that true representation is the documentary Assassin's Creed.
Nice.
Whereby, yeah.
Good. The Animus.
Yes.
As
the worst parts of those games.
Yes. Well, I mean, as you know, every lab that has an Animus lying around, every biology lab.
Yeah.
It's a crucial part.
We use them to actually go back in time to our gerbils' lives and see what they were doing, you know, back in the day.
What their ancestors were doing, yeah.
I'm really loving the idea of Adam, like, hooking up a gerbil to the Animus, and suddenly, like, the gerbil stands up, tosses a little hood over his head, and then just, like, runs along through the lab killing researchers, and Adam's...
jumps off the building into a pile of hay.
I want to know how far the Animus can take you back. Like, can you go back to Tiktaalik? Like, can you see your fishy ancestors from all those years back?
I hope so. Tossed off a cliff, never net this
rejected kid just got resurrected! So, as we know, mockbuster is a very clever portmanteau of the words mock and blockbuster. For those of you who don't know what a mockbuster is, it's also known as a knockbuster or drafting opportunity. It is a film created to piggyback off of the publicity of another major motion picture with a similar title or subject matter.
I did not know that.
They're often low budget and have quick production time to maximize profits. And mockbusters are generally produced concurrently with upcoming films and are released direct to video at the same time as the mainstream film reaches theaters or their video outlets.
To intentionally confuse grandmas buying gifts for their grandchildren.
Exactly. So a mockbuster may be similar enough in title or packaging to intentionally deceive consumers into mistakenly purchasing the derivative title. But producers often maintain that they are simply offering additional products for consumers who want to watch more films in the same subgenres.
Uh-huh.
How kind and thoughtful of them.
Ours is called Jurassic Jark, so it's different. Yeah.
Have you guys ever fallen victim to this, by the way?
That's a good question. I don't think so.
I don't believe that I have. I've seen so many unfortunate examples of the generic knockoff video games people's grandparents have gotten for them when they're like, is that game you liked? No, this is not the game I like. I was always, thankfully, very specific in detailing what I wanted, and my mom was pretty good about making sure that they got what I asked for and not some knockoff bullshit.
Oh, my grandparents used to do this all the time when I was a kid with either games or particularly action figures, where they'd show up and they'd be like, oh, like, we got the one you wanted, like Catman. And I'd be like, oh.
Why'd you give me this furry suit, Grandma?
This answers why you have so many cats now, Dave. Yeah, so Mockbusters actually have a pretty long history, not just in Hollywood, but in cinema worldwide. Back in 1959, the Van Wyck film, The Monster of Piedras Blancas. Does anybody know what that's a copy of?
No.
It is a clear copy of The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Ah.
And it even had the complete creature suit from the same designer as The Creature from the Black Lagoon. In the 90s, Good Times Entertainment is a production company that was notorious for distributing animated Mockbuster counterparts to popular Disney films. But because Disney was creating its films based on public domain, you know, hence folktales, historical stories, that kind of thing, Good Times was able to survive the onslaught of legal challenges brought against it by Disney. And that sort of set the precedent for Mockbusters going forward. Yeah, so Mockbusters are low budget, but low budgets also mean that directors need to think of creative yet cheap ways to achieve satisfying movie endings. So my favorite example for this is Snakes on a Train, capitalized the internet hype surrounding snakes on a plane. Consumers wanted what they saw, and so producer David Michael Latt said, and this is a direct quote, "With only 4 days left of shooting, my partner called and said, everyone is really excited about Snakes on a Train, but they're more excited about the poster, and the poster showed a snake swallowing a train. It was meant to be, you know, metaphorical, but the buyers wanted, so it was given... I was given the mandate that the ending had to have the snake eating a train."
That's what happens. The snake swallows the train whole.
Yeah. Yep. Largely, Mockbuster companies toe a very fine line, copyright line, and have largely, thanks to the Good Times versus Disney precedent, been able to operate free of legal ramifications. Only rarely has a major motion picture company succeeded in blocking the piggyback movie. In 2012, an example of this, a judge did end up ruling in favor of temporarily blocking the DVD release of a film titled The Age of Hobbits. And with legal tie-ups, the company ended up releasing it under the name Clash of Empires. So it's important to note that we tend to think of Mockbusters as cut-rate, over-the-counter, bad knockoffs, but it's not always the case. Hollywood is kind of like the stock market. You know, you hear rumors that vampires are going to be big this year, and so then that's why you end up having 3 vampire movies and 6 new TV series based on vampires. It's all about grabbing a piece of that saturated pie. So I kind of wanted to go through this is according to IMDb, the top Mockbusters. So I did 5 through 1, and I wanted to see if you guys knew any of those top Mockbusters. All right, so number 5 is Plan B.
Is that like a Mockbuster of the B movie?
It's the B movie.
Oh,
okay.
This is my personal favorite. Number 4, Ratatouing.
I've heard of this.
I cannot possibly guess what this is about.
Number 3, A Car's Life, Sparky's Big Adventure.
So this could be A Bug's Life with Cars, or Cars rip off directly.
It's, yeah, Cars. Number 2, Spider's Web, A Pig's Tale.
Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, Charlotte's Web. And number 1, which I want to see your faces, so I'm going to switch back to Discord. Number 1 is The Lego Movie.
Really?
Really?
Yep. Apparently, it is a Mockbuster ripoff of a 1970s movie called The Midnight Express.
The Lego Movie is a Mockbuster of The Midnight Express?
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't the... But what... How...
I've... Several sites have sort of, like, cited it as a purposeful Mockbuster.
Didn't we just define it as something designed to capitalize on the success
It can be. It not necessarily is.
Oh.
Huh.
It can be designed to capitalize on the success of a film in the past as well. But usually they release it at the same time.
Well then, yeah, call me a big fan of some Mockbusters then.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. Can I introduce just a subsection of Kung Fu Panda ripoff, Kung Fu Panda mockbusters here?
Yes, I also have some honorable mentions that I wanted to mention, and one of them is a Kung Fu Panda. So I'll start with mine, I'll let you go into yours. My honorable mention, yeah, Kung Fu Panda, was The Little Panda Fighter.
So building off that, because as we've spoken about before, I love Kung Fu Panda. And while we've been going through this, I have also been looking at a huge series of mockbusters of Kung Fu Panda. I did not know there'd be so many. So these are the top ones that I found. Chop Kick Panda.
Mm-hmm.
The Prodigy. The Little Panda Fighter, with some truly horrifying CG in that one. Panda Warrior, which stars Rob Schneider and Norm Macdonald, as well as Hayley Duff, who I think they were trying to convince people was Hilary Duff, but not quite. There is The Legend of Kung Fu Rabbit.
Adam and I have seen about 30 minutes of The Little Panda Fighter, and it is... I cannot express how horrifying... the animation is
so bad.
The Frozen ripoff Frozen Land, the Transformers ripoff Transmorphers, the ripoff of Up, simply titled What's Up.
What's Up? That was one of my honorable mentions.
The Fast and the Fierce,
and absolutely fantastic
Fast and the Fierce
Pacific Rim's ripoff Atlantic Rim, where you're just naming off oceans at this point.
In one of our older episodes, I used a clip from Atlantic Rim in an episode of ours. I can't remember which one it was, but I ended up watching parts of that movie, and it is horrendous.
There's also The Amazing Bulk.
Yes.
I did want to bring two examples that weren't like sort of those bad knockoff versions. So there's a movie that I actually watched a lot as a kid called Mac and Me, and that apparently was a mockbuster of E.T., which I didn't know. And then Big Daddy was the original movie, and the mockbuster of that was a movie called The Kid with Bruce Willis.
I lived in China for a semester when I studied abroad, and one of the interesting things about Chinese law is if it's going to benefit the Chinese and at the expense of some other country or other people or other business, they don't give a fuck. They're going to let the Chinese people get away with it. China and a lot of other countries in Southeast Asia are famous for ripping off products, not necessarily movies. And while I was in China, I saw not only full-blown Starbucks ripoffs, which were the exact same font, the exact same buildings, almost the exact same logo, but it's a Chinese Starbucks, so it's different. They also did this for entire cars. There were BMW ripoffs on the road that were just the Chinese version. But, and then BMW would, of course, try to sue them, and they're like, no, this is... obviously the Chinese car, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, it's not. But because they're suing them in China, China doesn't give a fuck.
Nice. Good. I mean, part of me is like, yeah, fuck these big corporations. And then the other half remembers it's the Chinese government doing this. And I'm like, they're also bad people.
Yeah.
Do we feel bad for the Carnosaur?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes,
100%.
I would say so. 100%.
It didn't choose to be ripped from the womb of a crazy scientist who wasn't that crazy or charismatic.
The fucking T-Rex spends a big chunk of the movie trapped behind lasers that burn it if it moves in any wrong direction. I'd be pissed off, too.
Yeah.
For sure.
I also feel bad for the chickens.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a brutal opening scene that I was not a fan of.
Who would you recommend this movie to?
People that I hate.
Yeah, okay. Enemies. I feel like this is only a movie for those people who really get a kick out of watching terrible movies, and even then they're probably not going to have a good time with it.
Mm-mm.
Don't get me wrong, I like having a few drinks and watching something like fucking Thanksgiving or The Room or 50 Shades of Grey, but this
Rubber.
This is another level of... not another level. This is just, it's bland, it's boring. It reminds me of when we watch Cats.
Next week, we'll be coming back with The Lost World, continuing our Dinosaur Palooza. Remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
That's really fabulous. Like a great theme park.